It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Rob Ferret. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to an expert from the American Lung Association in Wisconsin about electronic cigarettes. Are they safe? Will they help smokers quit? We'll get one take later on.
But first, a new law proposed in Wisconsin would raise the state speed limit to 70 miles an hour, up from 65.
Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss announced he will back the bill and submit it by Labor Day.
Critics say raising the speed limit is dangerous and could lead to more accidents on state highways. But Speaker Voss said speed limits in other Midwestern states like Minnesota and Iowa are at 70 miles an hour without problems.
Here to talk about what raising the speed limit could mean is Jonathan Adkins, Deputy Executive Director of the Governor's Highway Safety Association. Jonathan, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, glad to be there. Thank you.
Well, what do you think about raising the speed limit in Wisconsin to 70 miles an hour? Is that too much? Is it okay?
Well, we haven't looked specifically at Wisconsin, but we found in other states is that when speed limits go up, no surprise, driver speed go up. And when speeds go up and you're in a crash, you're less likely to survive. And even if you do survive, you may have a serious injury. We haven't been able to change the laws of physics, unfortunately. So again, when speed limits go up, there is a consequence. And the question is, are we willing to pay that?
It seems as though, speeding happens no matter what the speed limit is. Do you find that there is a danger threshold? In other words, is it okay to just bump it up by 5 miles an hour as opposed to 10?
Well, what we're seeing in other states is that states typically gradually increase speed limits. They'll go up 5, they may go up another 5. There is a cost to this, and what we have to remember is that in most cases, when you're driving and you see a speed limit sign, you think you can go 5, maybe even 7 miles an hour above that speed limit. And reality, in a lot of places, is that's true. So most people aren't driving at the speed limit. That's not a newsflash. So the actual speed in a lot of places in Wisconsin may end up being 75, 77 even. And that's certainly getting up there. And again, if you're in a crash, the likelihood of walking away with it, walking away from it rather, starts to decrease.
So it seems though that cars are built for better safety these days, and that it might be, or it might seem to the driver, that it's less dangerous to speed as it used to be. What do you say to that?
Well, cars are safer, and roads are safer, and so there is an argument to be made for that. But the numbers don't lie. In safety, we typically are losing about 10,000 people a year in speed-related crashes. And what's alarming about that is that number really hasn't gone down much. In highway safety, we've made a lot of progress in other areas. As you mentioned, vehicles are safer. Drunk driving is down. Seatbelt use is up in Wisconsin and around the country. There's generally speaking greater awareness about highway safety. We're starting to address distracted driving, and cell phone use and that sort of thing. But speed is really a neglected issue, and it's one that we're just not making much progress. So perhaps it is safer than it once was. But when we're losing 10,000 people a year in the country, that's huge.
What about rural highways, though, where maybe the threat of hitting another car isn't as apparent to us?
Well, on rural two-lane roads, certainly you could run into a car in the opposite direction. Rural roads have a huge problem of runoff the road crashes and incidents. We haven't been able to change the laws of physics. Speed is a significant issue. 70 may not sound a lot, but the key to that will be, and if Wisconsin goes to that limit, is to enforce it, is to let the public know that the speed limit is 65 or 70 in this case, and if you go above it, you are going to get a ticket. And there are ways to enforce these laws other than traditional enforcement of having law enforcement out. We support cameras and automated enforcement in some circumstances. That is a way to reduce speed. But the best thing still to do to reduce speed is to have a highly visible law enforcement presence. If people think they're going to get a ticket, they tend to slow down.
Hmm. Does that simply involve having sheriff deputies down every highway, or are there other, maybe, I don't know if automated is the right term, but human-free forms of law enforcement, like, flashing lights and things like that?
Yeah, flashing lights can do it, cameras, where that if you're at a certain speed, you're going to get a ticket in the mail. Nobody likes to get that. Once you get one, you don't forget it. But again, you know, having that highly visible presence, seeing law enforcement out, checking for speeds, making sure that there's not other dangerous behavior going on, makes a big difference. Speed is an issue that the public doesn't see as a safety issue. Typically in states, there's not a whole lot of debate about increasing the speed limits. Your neighbors in Illinois, that has been an exception to the rule. There's been quite a bit of public debate about raising the speed limit in that state. But Ohio raised their speed limit a few years ago. Virginia just did not long ago. There's a stretch of road in Texas now that's 85 miles an hour, believe it or not. The public wants to go faster. They don't see this as a safety concern. So we have our work cut out for us, for those of us in highway safety.
Well, can you think of any good argument for raising the speed limit? Or could you think of a condition where you would actually support it? Maybe passing the new law alongside another law that would enhance safety, perhaps banning the use of cell phones or other things that would, you know, send drivers toward, a better success rate?
No, because speed is, one of the biggest factors in crashes. It's, about 10,000 lives every year, as I believe I said. And so we really have to address speed. It's not a trade-off that we should be willing to take. When you lose that many people every year, these crashes are totally preventable. It's not some mystery why they occur. Drivers are going too fast. They hit another car or an object of some sort, because they're going so fast, the collision is so intense that they don't survive. They're horrible, gruesome deaths, and we have to try to raise awareness about that. And regardless of what the speed limit is, we're all in a rush. We all have to pick up our kids after work. We've got 10 things to do on Saturday afternoon, but we've got to slow down a little bit, literally and figuratively. That'll make a big difference. It'll save us a few bucks in the wallet too. Gas prices are going up, and when you speed, you really sort of ruin your fuel efficiency as well. So, save your life and save a few bucks too.
So, when the maximum speed limit goes up, do you typically see a raise in the minimum speed limit as well?
As far as on a state by state basis.
Yeah, what trends have you seen there?
We don't really pay as much attention to the minimum speed limit, I can't comment on that. But the trend we're seeing, is every year between 5 and 10 states, speeds are increasing. And it used to be we were talking about like what we are in Wisconsin going to 70, which is pretty moderate. But in other states, it's 75, 80. And as I mentioned, there's a stretch in Texas that's 85. So depending on your perspective on this issue, Wisconsin's a little bit behind, but that's obviously not our perspective.
Well, what would you recommend that our state lawmakers keep in mind as they consider this bill in Wisconsin?
Well, they need to look at safety considerations. They need to talk to folks in their engineering community, talk to the Department of Transportation, which I'm sure they're doing, and get a recommendation from them. But it needs to, the decision needs to be not only based on convenience, but it needs to be based on safety, and look at how many crashes in Wisconsin involve speed, and then maybe look at some other states that have increased their speed limit and see what those states are showing. That data is available. The state transportation departments work together. They network. So see what the impact has been in other states. And from our vantage point, that impact has been negative in a lot of cases.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for being with us.
Sounds good. I appreciate the call.
That was Jonathan Adkins, Deputy Executive Director of the Governor's Highway Safety Association.
And you can hear more about the proposed law in Wisconsin tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock on the Joy Cardine Show, or you can voice your thoughts right now on the Central Time Facebook page. And on this topic, Juanita has said, this is absurd. Let's increase speed while we have all these distracted drivers on the road. And no, I'm not advocating for a 50 miles an hour speed limit. Any increase in speed over 50 lowers your miles per gallon. And Simon says, no, it uses more gas and speed kills. Well, what do you think? You can join us on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, we'll talk to an expert with the American Lung Association in Wisconsin about e-cigarettes. What are they? Are they safe? And are they a good way to quit smoking? We'll find out. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Electronic cigarettes, or e-cigarettes as they're called, seem to be everywhere these days, and they're being sold as a way to help smokers quit and as a safer alternative to smoking.
But some critics worry that vaping, the term used to describe using e-cigarettes, is more dangerous than distributors might want you to believe.
Here to talk about what e-cigarettes are and whether they're helpful or harmful is Donna Wininski, Director of Public Policy and Communications for the American Lung Association in Wisconsin. Donna, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much, Cynthia and Veronica. I'm glad to be on.
Well, let's start with the evidence. What do we know about whether or not e-cigarettes help smokers quit?
Well, we actually know very little from a scientific standpoint. The Lung Association has been around for over 100 years, and part of the reason is that we base all of our positions, our policy positions, on documented, peer-reviewed scientific evidence. And in the case of e-cigarettes, that's actually what's lacking. We don't know if they're safer. We don't know if they're effective for helping smokers quit. There is just not enough scientific documentation out there yet. And right now they are going around largely unregulated, certainly on the federal level. There are some states that have some local laws having to do with youth access and whether kids under 18 can purchase them. But by and large, right now, they're an unregulated product, and that does concern us.
Can you tell us a little bit about what exactly an e-cigarette is and how it works?
It's a battery-operated device. It looks virtually identical to a cigarette, which is one of the things that smokers find so attractive about it. It really mimics the actual smoking habit. It has a cartridge on it that contains nicotine, a little battery-operated cartridge, and that nicotine can come in a variety of flavors, for example, bubble gum, fruit flavors, cotton candy. It's not just straight tobacco for adult users. That's another concern that we have, that these things are appealing to kids. So you attach a cartridge and you get your hit of nicotine and whatever other flavorings and chemicals are in there, and you inhale that into your lungs just like you would a cigarette. And when the cartridge is empty, you replace it with another cartridge.
Now, reading about this a bit today, there have been some studies. Now, they've been funded by the makers of electronic cigarettes. I want to put that out there right away. But according to their studies, they have shown that people are using e-cigarettes to help quit, and that some people in the study quit altogether, even when, you know, they went into the study not being terribly motivated to smoke cigarettes. I mean, obviously, you have to look at where the study is coming from, but what do you make of evidence like that?
Well, you have to look at both where the study is coming from and the volume of evidence. Again, it takes more than one or two or even a handful of studies to really come up with conclusive science. And this may be just scratching the surface of the iceberg, but we really believe also that the FDA is probably the only unbiased authority to do these kinds of clinical research studies and have them reviewed by peer-reviewed publications and really come up with evidence and conclusions out of this evidence that doesn't have a bias in one direction or another.
Now, what are the downsides as you see it? You mentioned the chemicals that might be in there. What are you worried is in e-cigarettes that we don't know about?
Well, we have, in some of the limited research that's been done, there have been a number of chemicals identified, and in fact, in one particular study, there were 17 chemicals that are on the California list with Proposition 65. Proposition 65 is a state law that was passed in California that says any product that contains any one of a long list of chemicals that are known to be hazardous. If a product contains any of those have to be disclosed to the public. And this particular product that was tested contained 17 of those chemicals. So that's kind of a red flag right there. I mean, we have seen other types of chemicals. Formaldehyde has been discovered in a couple of these different tests. Acetaldehyde has been discovered. Acetone, which is in nail polish. It's really, again, we're just hitting the tip of the iceberg in terms of doing some of the research, and we need a larger body out there before we can see whether they're safe or not and whether they're effective or not.
Now, the companies who make e-cigarettes are billing them as a way to stop smoking and, I guess, still enjoy nicotine maybe as well a little bit. But on the other hand, you could see that this would be something that could be used as sort of a gateway, not a drug, but a gateway to using actual cigarettes. Is that possible, do you think?
Well, that's another one of our concerns. We are troubled that they might start kids on the path of a lifetime of nicotine addiction, especially if you're talking about fruit and candy flavored products. Those are always attractive to kids. And kids, if they believe that one product is less dangerous than another, they may choose to use that product, whereas if that product didn't exist or hadn't been introduced on the market available to them, they might not have smoked at all. That's a big concern. Some people, yes, will claim that e-cigarettes have helped them quit smoking, and somewhere down the road we may discover that they are a smoking cessation device, but we don't know that right now. And the other concern about that is that people are dual using. They're not necessarily using them to quit smoking, but they're using them when they can't smoke. So they're doing both. They're using e-cigarettes in a smoke-free environment, and then they're smoking regular cigarettes when they're able to. So these are all concerns that we have about e-cigarettes.
So with a regular tobacco cigarette, you've got to worry about secondhand smoke, according to some of the research out there. Now, with e-cigarettes, if someone's using them, or as the term is, vaping, is there that same danger?
Again, limited studies, but I do have a copy of one in front of me from a publication called Indoor Air, and that did find some increases in the volatile organic compounds, VOCs specifically, acetaldehyde, acetone, formaldehyde. It doesn't list the concentrations, whether they're dangerous in terms of the ambient air quality, but it certainly does say that they were measurable and they were present. At the Lung Association, our position is you shouldn't be breathing in anything that you don't know what it is or how it could impact you. And just because some people or some studies might say, well, it's not as dangerous as a cigarette and may provide some limited evidence that it's not as dangerous as a cigarette, until you know the extent of the danger, you really shouldn't be inhaling it.
Now, you've been throwing out the names of a lot of pretty scary sounding chemicals. Formaldehyde, acetone formaldehyde, we know in some forms is considered a carcinogen. So if we know about all these chemicals, and you just listed a bunch, and you said in California 15 chemicals have shown up, why isn't the FDA on this?
Well, that's a very good question, and we're hoping that the FDA will get on this. They have done some initial research. They initially had tried to regulate them as drug delivery devices, and we at the Lung Association felt that that was a very good tack to take. We didn't want to see them regulated as tobacco products. We wanted to see them regulated as drug delivery devices, and they did attempt to do that. And unfortunately, these e-cigarette companies filed suit against them, and the decision was thrown out. And so the FDA doesn't have that ability. Right now, the FDA has no ability without the court's permission to do any kind of regulation over these products. That's why I said they're largely unregulated, except potentially in a handful of states that have laws prohibiting youth access to them.
Who is making e-cigarettes? I mean, is it the big tobacco companies?
Wow. Well, right now there's probably over 250 e-cigarette brands for sale today. Probably they're not all individual companies. I'm sure that certain companies have a variety of different products. But yes, we are seeing the tobacco companies get into that arena. Originally, they weren't the manufacturers, but I think they're seeing the handwriting on the wall too, especially since so many states have now passed smoke-free air laws. And they're starting to get into the market too, either manufacturing their own or buying out companies that were already in existence.
Well, Donna, thank you so much for being with us and talking about this today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
That was Donna Wininski, Director of Public Policy and Communications for the American Lung Association in Wisconsin. And we'd love to know what you think about e-cigarettes. Do you think they're safe? Have you used them? Have they maybe even helped you quit smoking? Let us know what your experience is on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, our guest says if you're overqualified for your job, you're more likely to be depressed.
And we've got another nostalgia segment coming up tomorrow, and we'll be talking with a guest who remembers when he first fell in love with dictionaries and it launched him into a lifelong love affair with words. We'll hear about that in tomorrow's nostalgia segment.
And we'll also learn about the history and tradition of soul food.
And that is all coming up tomorrow. Stay with us. You're listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later in the program, we'll get the latest on the situation in Egypt.
Shipping, though, is sort of an out-of-sight, out-of-mind industry. But according to our next guest, almost every aspect of our lives is touched by it.
There are more than 100,000 ships at sea carrying all the solids, liquids, and gases that we need to live. That's according to our next guest, who spent some time on one of these ships to get a better sense of what's actually happening in this mostly hidden industry.
Rose George is an author and journalist. Her new book is 90% of Everything, Inside Shipping, the Invisible Industry that Puts Clothes on our Back, Gas in Your Car, and Food on Your Plate. Rose, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So let's start with the title of your book, 90% of Everything. Give us a sense of how the shipping industry impacts pretty much everything that we do.
Well, when I started thinking about this subject, I used to ask friends just to guess how much of trade stuff travels by ship, because people think of shipping as kind of a historical thing. You know, maybe they last noticed it in the Second World War, and they usually come up with 20%, 30%, maybe 50%. But it's actually 90%, hence the title, 90% of Everything. So 90% of all world trade is shipped by sea at some point.
So we're talking, like, I imagine electronics, some clothing. What are we receiving on our by
well,
shipping?
Let's play a game. So okay. I'm sitting at my kitchen table in my house, and I'm looking at a glass vase with some flowers in it. I'm looking at a teapot. I'm looking at an iPhone. I'm looking at an iPad. And I suspect that nearly all those things, maybe not the flowers, they probably came by air, but nearly everything else probably came by ship. So with pretty much anything, unless you know it's local, unless you know it's produced in the United States, you can assume it got to you by ship at some point.
It seems primitive to continue to rely on shipping by sea when there are more modern means of travel, like air travel. You mentioned flowers coming by air. Why is shipping still around?
Shipping is an extremely modern industry. These massive ships, some of those 100,000 working vessels that you mentioned, you go onto their bridges and they look like the cabin of a plane. You know, some of the technology. There's nothing old-fashioned about shipping except that they maybe go slowly at sea. But the reason that they're still so fundamental to our economy is that it's cheap. So, and the reason it's cheap is because of something called the box, the container. So when containerization began in the 1960s and 70s, it created this very efficient industry where one unit, a container, could be moved from a ship to a truck to a train. So that was extremely efficient, cut out a lot of costs. It used to cost a lot of money to transport something to a port. Now it's much cheaper.
So how much can you fit on one of those containers, and then how many containers are on a ship?
Again, it depends on the size of the ship. So the ship I was on, the Maersk Kendall, was... I thought when I was standing beneath it on the quay at Felixstowe in England, just about to go to sea for 5 weeks, I thought it was the biggest thing I'd ever seen. That was actually a medium-sized ship, and that was the length of three soccer pitches. It was about 10 stories in height, the accommodation house coming up from the deck, so that's the part where people live. It was absolutely ginormous, but it's actually pretty small. So that carried 6,500, they're called TEUs, 20-foot equivalent units. That's the average size of a container. There is now Maersk, the company who owned the ship I was on, has just launched its Triple E ship, which is carrying 18,000 containers.
Wow.
So it can be manned by that ship with 18,000 containers can be manned by 13 people.
Wow. So if you could put that into perspective a little bit, like how many, I don't know, say those containers are carrying flat screen TVs. I mean, how many products are we talking about? How many people are served by that one shipment?
Oh, way too many to count. I mean, each container could have dozens and dozens of cartons of discrete things. I mean, we're talking millions of things, possibly, on a container ship.
Wow. So you spent 29 days, I think, on this ship. Could you talk a little bit about what life was like on the ship? Who's working on that ship?
So the ship I was on was Maersk Kendall, was departed from the UK. It had a regular loop. So it was like a commuter, really. It was commuting to Asia and back. So it would go to Asia, it would get lots of goods that we import from Asia, and it would come back on the same loop. And the people on the ship were, well, I'll paint you a picture of when I first sat down to dinner in the officer's saloon. So next to me was a Burmese guy. Opposite me was a Romanian. There was a Moldavian, two Brits, two Romanians, behind me a Chinese, and in the next room, in the crew room, so the non-officers, they were all Filipino, which is pretty standard on ships. Mm-hmm. Filipinos make up a quarter of all seafarers, because in their words, they are cheap and they speak good English.
Hmm.
So the average ship these days is going to be, probably it's going to have a multinational crew. It's going to have Filipinos, Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, Romanians, Ukrainians, Russians. What it probably won't have is Americans or Brits or Western Europeans, because they now seem to be quite expensive, and ships don't have to fly their own sovereign flag anymore. They can do what's called flagging out.
Oh, really? So, and they're mostly men?
There was actually a woman on my ship, but 98% of seafarers are men, yes. It's a very, very male industry. But the cook on my ship was called a Pinky, and she's a woman, and she's a Filipina. That was a surprise to me. I didn't expect to find her there, but I was glad to have her.
Mm-hmm.
But the crew on my ship, they were really lovely. They treated me really, really well, and to the extent that I didn't want to get off after 5 weeks, and they thought I was crazy.
Well, and I understand that you had that was a special privilege to be on that ship. They don't let just anybody on there.
No, they don't. I mean, Maersk is the most gigantic and most important company that most people have never heard of. So it's I call it the Microsoft or Coca-Cola of shipping. It's huge. I mean, its revenues are equivalent to Microsoft's, but we just don't really know about it. But it's a Danish company, and it's, as shipping companies go, it's not the most open of industries, and they're actually pretty open. So they, after I asked them very politely for quite a long time, over 6 or 7 months, they said, okay, you can go on our ship. But they don't take passengers. Some cargo ships do take paying passengers, but nobody at that point in 2010 was taking paying passengers on the route that I was going, because I was going through pirate waters. I was going through the Indian Ocean on the way to Asia.
Yeah, talk about that route a little bit.
So we went down south of Europe, and then we went down the Suez Canal, which I was quite looking forward to, but the crew says it's just a ditch in a desert. And after 12 hours of looking at sand, you tend to agree. And then at the bottom of the Suez Canal, coming out after about another day sailing, we came to the Gulf of Aden, and that was where the dangerous waters began. So our ship was considered to be safe because it was bigger than pirates had attacked before, so they couldn't easily scale the side with ladders. But even so, I was pretty scared. I'd been quite blasé up to that point, but when they started blocking out the windows and snapping all the blinds into place every evening and putting double watch on the bridge, so two men on the bridge instead of one, then I started to get a bit nervous. And you'd start to hear on the radio the other ships talking about, you know, attacks that had happened. And you'd start to see the grey frigates and warships of the European and other military patrols in the area. So it started to get a little bit nerve-wracking.
Yeah, geez, this is a whole other, another world that, I mean, you talk about how we're not completely aware of the fact that so many of our products are coming by sea, but all the issues surrounding that as well, it's so vast.
Well, when I went to sea in 2010, in the summer of 2010, that was the golden age of Somali piracy, and 2010 into sort of halfway through 2011. And at one point, there were 544 seafarers being held hostage by Somali pirates. And again, I would ask my friends, how many hostages do you think are being held? And they'd say 10 or 12 or something. And it was just an enormous amount of men who had just been imprisoned, often in really difficult, often brutal conditions, just for doing their job. They were held for ransom for months, sometimes years, and then released when a ransom was paid, and only when a ransom was paid.
Wow. Well, we are talking with Rose George. She's the author of a new book called 90% of Everything. And we're talking about the shipping industry, some of the issues surrounding it, too, that we may not have thought about before. If you have a question or comment for her, you can let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. We're talking with Rose George about her new book, 90% of Everything.
Well, what about you? Do you think about where your clothes and your food come from? And are we over-reliant on shipping without really knowing what happens on these ships that supply us? If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or leave us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Rose, we were talking before the break about some of the dangers of working on one of these ships. And we're talking about your voyage through what you feared would be pirate waters. Can you talk a little bit about some of the precautions that are taken to withstand some of those dangers?
Sure. I mean, specifically when it comes to piracy, I mean, luckily piracy has diminished a lot now in those waters. It started in other places. But so with regards to piracy, the protections you could do is kind of maneuvering. So you could do zigzagging, you could speed up the ship. You could kind of put round barbed wire or netting or have hoses. But, you know, if you were faced with four guys in a small, fast boat with AK-47s and a rocket-propelled grenade, none of those things were really going to help you. In general, I mean, I said that shipping was a very modern, highly technological industry, which it is, but there is an essential truth about shipping, is that it's operating in the most dangerous place on our planet, which is the ocean. And a ship, no matter how advanced, can sink. And two ships a week sink. And
really?
2,000 seafarers a year die because it's a dangerous environment. They're in a heavy industry environment on the very dangerous, potentially dangerous ocean. And it's no wonder that it's the second most dangerous industry in the world after fishing.
So these people that you got to know on the ship that you sailed on, the Kendall, did you talk to them about this? Did you ask them what keeps them going and why they choose, why they stay in that industry?
I did, and they didn't talk so much about the dangers because they sort of took that in their stride after, you know, they were being kind of male about it. But they were quite vocal about how lonely an existence it is. And in fact, some of the Filipino guys would say that what they say their job is it's dollar for homesickness. So they've missed the births of their children, never mind the birthdays, but all the births.
Mm.
And they spend up to nine months of the year at sea. And at sea, they don't have internet access either. Only a third of seafarers have internet access at sea. They have satellite phones, but they're expensive, so they don't have cell phones, they don't have TV. I mean, they don't have any of sort of modern communications that the average five-year-old kid takes for granted these days. So it can be a really lonely existence. There is a lot of beauty in it as well. There is obviously the immensity of the ocean. There is all that kind of calmness. But they're basically extremely tired. It's a very intense job, and they miss their families.
Well, let's take a call from Patrick in Toma. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Sure. What's your question?
My question is, I saw it on an episode of The Wire, because one of the seasons was about a shipyard in Baltimore. Do they ever have issues with humans being trafficked in the crates? In this particular instance in the show, they had a hole with punctured through the top so that the people could breathe, and they, you know, were smuggling people into the U.S. Is that ever an issue?
Yes, it certainly is. And, I mean, if we ship nearly everything by ships and in containers, then that includes every, you know, it includes contraband, it includes people, so people are trafficked. I have not been able to find a authoritative figure, a total, because nobody really knows. But certainly you can find in local newspapers accounts of women who end up being trafficked into brothels or into sort of slave labor situations in the U.S. and in Europe. There was a famous case in a guy called Container Bob, who was found in an Italian port, and he'd sort of set up home in this shipping container, and the only reason he was found out is because he started punching out a hole to make a window. And he was actually considered to be a security risk because he had airport passes and stuff, but he was released. He was found not to be any danger, and he was released. But it certainly happened, yes.
How rigorous is the inspection process? How is this even allowed to happen?
Well, because only worldwide, only about 10% of containers are physically inspected. And the reason for that is that if you did any more than that, you would slow down trade, and that would cost a lot of money. Hmm. If a port stops, if one of the big ports like Long Beach stops, then that's hundreds of thousands, probably more dollars a day that are lost because trade is not getting through. Now, people who work in container security will say that containers are secure, they have locks, but anecdotally I've been told that it's not difficult to break those locks and replace them convincingly. And in fact, the U.S. government did a report that said the same thing. But they will also tell you that there's enough intelligence and sort of prediction to be able to keep us safe. And, well, I guess so far it's working, but it's not a perfect science.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how the TEU, the shipping container, revolutionized commerce. And why exactly has shipping quadrupled since 1970?
Well, because trade has quadrupled, and also because the efficiencies and the economies that the shipping container brought to industry sort of fueled globalization and sort of fueled, certainly underpinned, certainly were fundamental to the rise of us getting all our cheap clothes and cheap T-shirts from Asia being shipped to us in the U.S. and Europe. And it just made trade more global and bigger.
I think I read that you said that it's now more efficient for a Scottish fisherman to send his fish off to China to be filleted and then have it sent back to Scotland before being sold than it would be to just take care of it in Scotland. Did I understand that correctly? And how can that be?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's one of the remarkable things about shipping is it can be so efficient and so economic that it depends on what's happening to the economy at the time. But if things are really difficult for shippers and there's a lot of competition, then sometimes it can cost you pretty much nothing to send something by a container. So, yes, it's very cheap, and the same happens with, I think it was shrimp producers in California do a similar thing. It's pretty common.
So let's talk a little bit about the environmental impact of all this shipping. What is it doing to, let's say, the oceans first?
What it's doing to the ocean is it's making it a very noisy and very uncomfortable and possibly dangerous place for ocean creatures. So I looked in particular at the North Atlantic right whale, which lives off the eastern seaboard of the U.S. It's critically endangered. There's only about 400 of them left. But the problem with the right whale is it's chosen to live near shipping lanes. And if you are underwater, most ocean animals and mammals use sound to communicate because sound travels much more quickly underwater. Light disappears. pretty quickly when you start going descending through the water. So they use sound, and when you've got a massive ship, even one the size that I was on, it's got massive engines, it's got massive propellers, and it's making an awful lot of noise underwater. And that, the research is still going on, but we think it contributes to really bad stress levels in whales. It's certainly reduced their acoustic range, sometimes by up to 90%, so they can't find mates, they can't find feeding grounds. It's got all sorts of impacts.
Why should we be concerned about that?
Because we don't want to get rid of the North Atlantic right whale, for a start. We also don't want to damage the habitat of humpback whales, of blue whales, of all sorts of ocean creatures. And it's also inefficient for ships, actually, because if their propellers are noisy, then they're not being efficient. They're only producing noise because they're operating inefficiently. So there's that argument as well. Hopefully one of those two arguments will sway the shipping industry. And they are making efforts to produce quieter propellers, but it's difficult because there are those 100,000 ships and you can't retrofit every single ship.
Would it be greener, quote unquote, to choose another method like air travel, or would that make a difference at all?
No, absolutely not, because shipping does contribute to global emissions. It's also got, we've just talked about the sound in the ocean, but it's also got an impact on the air. It does contribute global emissions, which are pretty high, about 4%, which is a little bit more than aviation. People argue about it, but it's around about between 3.7 and 4%. Now, that means that even though shipping is actually green, because per mile traveled, its carbon emissions are about, they're certainly 11 times less than a truck, and they're about 1,000 times less than a plane. So it is a green method of transport, but at the same time, because there's so much of it, it's not benign. It's not completely, it's not innocent of causing emissions. And people are starting to look at that now.
I see. Well, in our last minute here, can anything be done to clean up the shipping industry?
Yes, it can become more transparent. It can be less inward looking. And that is also starting to happen. This is actually a pretty interesting time. So, for example, Maersk is really, really good at social media now. It's got this fantastic website called wearemaersk.com, which really gives you a really good insight into what a ship does and what it can do. The entrepreneur Richard Branson is also looking at the carbon emissions from shipping. So things are moving and things are getting a little bit more open, but it's a very insular industry. It's been like that for a long time. Nobody really took any notice of it. So it got on with doing its thing. But I think it's learning to open up, and I think it should. And I think we should start, thinking of shipping miles as well as air miles and just start looking at shipping and paying attention to it.
Well, Rose, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Rose George is an author and journalist. Her new book is 90% of Everything, Inside Shipping, the Invisible Industry That Puts Clothes on Your Back, Gas in Your Car, and Food on Your Plate.
Coming up next, we'll take a look at the current situation in Egypt following a week of bloodshed. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.